Welcome to the latest edition of the Ask Qubit About Analytics podcast, brought to you by Qubit, the trusted experts in analytics. Our goal is to cut through the jargon and hype around analytics and data science and share practical advice to guide you on your analytics journey. You can find us at qubit.com, that's Q-U-E-B-I-T.com. Thank you for joining me today. I'm A.G. Tan.
Although Qubit has a lot of general expertise in analytics technologies, including data management, business intelligence, enterprise reporting, and advanced analytics, we also have a ton of very specific expertise in financial planning and analysis, or FP&A. The FP&A function in any company is often the core data analysis and analytics function in a company. Even a company that is relatively new to leveraging analytics to drive business decisions in general is likely to put energy and time into planning and then measuring performance against that plan. FP&A is the conduit through which strategy is implemented and monitored. FP&A is therefore a natural hub for analytics and data science in any enterprise, given its connection to strategic priorities and its traditional rigor around data accuracy and governance coming from its roots in accounting and finance. My guest today is Andreas Kugelmeier, who is an executive consultant and planning analytics architect at the IBM Data and AI Labs. Andreas and I share a similarly long tenure as business and financial analytics consultants, and I always enjoy connecting with him to compare notes and to learn. Welcome, Andreas. Thank you for being here.
Hello, AG. It's a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you.
Our topic today is innovation, and we're going to use the FP&A function as a kind of case study to discuss innovation. So, Andreas, tell me about the kinds of innovation you're thinking about and how innovation brings value to a business.
If we just look at FP&A, for example, like standard FP&A, I feel there's a lot of potential for innovation. And that lies really in modern driver-based. And then, when I'll speak to that later, AI-supported FP&A processes. And they can produce very accurate predictions of, let's say, monthly or quarterly performance. And in the best case, such modern FP&A processes can predict a potential, let's say, an earnings miss or any other performance hit, while even suggesting a remediation activities that may prevent such an earnings miss, let's say, from occurring. That's the best case. In the worst case, such processes still allow a company to be prepared, as in at least you do not encounter an unexpected earnings miss. And in any case, they'll produce timely, as in valuable, insights into what is happening and what will be happening from a financial performance perspective. And if we think about the types of innovation, I'd see that they occur in three areas. I'd like to divvy it up into three areas. One is really the processes and the performance drivers. And the innovation there lies in aligning aligning FP&A tighter with what is going on in the business, aligning FP&A with tighter with operational activities. So I'd like to say it's putting the analysis back into FP&A. That includes more granular sales analysis, let's say, as well as cost data forecasts, predictions, and risk as well. In order for innovation there to be occurring, there needs to be a want, as in a desire to change the process, and clearly describe where one wants to be and what will be needed to get there. So process is one area. The other is really the mindset. And, you know, it's I like to speak of the FP&A mindset. In some corporations, financial analytics and even FP&A are implicitly treated as extensions of accounting and financial controlling. So, and the problem there in an extreme example is that accounting mindset can quickly lead to FP&A processes that are way too atomistic to be efficient in analyzing and managing financial performance. So I'd like to say is that the focus for FP&A, or it's important to focus on what is material to the business. Now, if we look at the ledger and chart of accounts, there are means to link our FP&A processes to actual performance, financial performance, but they're not the drivers of FP&A. So the chart of accounts is an important building block for FP&A processes from a technical perspective, but it's not the blueprint. So sometimes one has to, in situations like that, it's good to have the financial controller take the back seat and focus on FP&A.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to make sure that I understand what you're saying. So are you basically saying that sometimes there's too much focus on detail and therefore people lose sight of the big picture?
Yes, absolutely. The big picture in the sense that sometimes we find that the focus is, or the legacy of FP&A in some organizations tends to be driven by the mindset of a financial controller, where it's less about predicting and forecasting business performance, but more about planning and budgeting at a ledger-based detail. And that desire to be perfectly accurate leads to processes that tend to be too detailed and that are very difficult to use for actually predicting financial performance, analyzing performance fast and accurately.
So I've seen this. It's almost like the 80-20 rule, and maybe it's understandable because accountants, when they're dealing with actuals and financial reporting, obviously have to be very accurate. But then when you are planning the future and building a model of your business, you know, the 80-20 rule is where, you know, you get to a point where there's the law of diminishing returns kicks in, where trying to add more accuracy to your model really doesn't get you more benefit because it's just a model, right? And by definition, then that there is no concept of being, you know, absolutely correct.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So, we were talking about the three areas. So the last area is then, and it's really the last. I like to say it's the last innovation area, and then is software and the, let's say, finance information architecture and the infrastructure. So to support modern FP&A, we need granular information, as in we need data, and we need that information on what is happening now in the business, what happened in the past, and we need to be able to access this information, this data, and analyze it, and that's what we need the software for. And so we have an information architecture around software infrastructure and so forth, and we have these tools. But that's the third area. And the third area really should only come after we have innovated on the procedural side, because the software is just, in a way, just an enabler of a process that was innovative, that a process that is to or shall create value.
So I think what I hear you saying there is that it really needs to be driven by the business process and by strategy and by mindset to some extent. And the tools are an enabler for that, but the tools should not be driving any of that. Is that correct, fair to say?
Yes. If we start with the tools themselves, in what will probably end up happening, and I've seen this happen, is that you use the tool to build a slightly better version of your current process, but the tools aren't by themselves don't really cause process change. The tools really don't change the mindset of the company. There needs to be a desire to change process, and that desire and the underlying change that follows that will then lead to an infrastructure strategy to change on the software infrastructure side, to change in how software is used, which software is used, and that then will help the process change. It will enable process change and create value.
Are there areas of low-hanging fruit that you see, you know, many companies resisting?
I think the low-hanging fruit is lies primarily in a core finance information architecture. The difficult, and that's not a low-hanging fruit, is the process change, desire to change process and to understand where the process shall go. And there are a lot of companies that understand that, and I feel that then there's once companies understand that and they understand here we need to improve our finance information architecture, we need to have better access to data, but there's so much going on. That's really the low-hanging fruit, and it's the low-hanging fruit because I think people get often intimidated. We get intimidated by the concept of, let's say, data lakes, by the vastness of that data that they would like to harness. There's so much complexity. We feel that we are more complex than other companies. Actually, in a way, every company is very complex. So we have a hard time seeing the forest for the trees. And what often happens then, the companies will modernize their software, but they'll still follow the traditional process because they're kind of intimidated by the vastness of the project. And I'd say building a core finance information architecture, meaning not just focus on the traditional FP&A, bring more sales data in, focus on really, let's say, for example, if sales revenue is a driver, focus on the essential data for FP&A and bring that data in. It's not really as intimidated as it may seem. Choose a software platform that can handle the vastness of that data well. And really just start there, start quote unquote smaller and then grow. And I think that's to me the low hanging fruit to just say, okay, we want to get to something very big and grandiose and very, very valuable, but how do we get there? Let's go about it in stages.
Mm. Yeah. So, you know, sometimes I feel that let's say this is a finance driven initiative, but then the notion of pulling in other data that might be very valuable for financial analysis becomes daunting because of politics or because of silos or because of a concern that you can't get other parts of the company to cooperate willingly with you, not because they don't want to, but perhaps because they have competing priorities. And that can then sometimes, you know, deter people from taking that next step. But you used the example of sales data. So I think what you're saying is that even in the face of those kinds of daunting prospects, what you could do is just pick one. Maybe it's sales data. And start focusing on that and looking for ways to get that data in and asking the people who will get you sales data, as opposed to worrying about sales and operations data and production data and blah 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 blah, right?
We don't want to boil the ocean, and you know, you can then leverage that first, let's say, project that really vastly already improved your finance information architecture as a success story. And what often happens then is that other business groups, other BUs will be more willing, more eager to jump on board, to jump on that innovation bandwagon of people.
Right, right. Because success breeds success, right? So you can take lessons learned from your first expansion, and then you're giving people much better data, and then, you know, you can get involved with other groups and start promising them better data too, and hopefully it grows from there.
Yep. And that's how we've seen our most successful customers in analytics really not operate but grow. It's really been a small success story that became a bigger one, and that then turned into many success stories, and the innovation just keeps on occurring and occurring.
Yeah. So one of the things you've written about is using the introduction of a new technology, for example, like IBM Planning Analytics, to help trigger innovation and the business process change that goes along with it. Can you maybe explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so planning analytics can become a very critical enabler of transformation and innovation at FBA, and we've seen it be a critical enabler of transformation and innovation. Once the moment is there that a company embraces the need to change the FP&A process and build a modern finance information architecture. And the reason that planning analytics becomes this significant enabler is largely because it embraces the analysis of high to very high data volumes. And so there are a lot of FP&A software solutions out there that lack the ability to really support analysis of billions of records. And people might say, why do I need to analyze billions of records? If we get to granular sales data and customer-based analysis, customer profitability, that is billions of records. So if you have an FP&A software that focuses just on, let's say, quote-unquote, classic forecasting planning and corresponding higher level analysis, that's not necessarily creating as much value. It's the ability to support very high data volumes into the billions of populated records that becomes a game changer for FP&A. And what happens then is that these solutions, these planning analytics solutions, allow the analyst to really quickly ask the right question and get a very accurate answer using all this granular data, and hence gain those data-driven insights, such as, say, take which products, which customers have been profitable. There are still a lot of customers who don't really have good answers for questions like that, or maybe it takes just days to produce that answer. Or another insight would be which customer may have been profitable, but possibly too risky, right? Risk data is important too, right?
Do you think you can help us understand it a little bit more clearly with perhaps an example?
Yeah, so one of my favorite examples is one of a financial services company, a customer of ours, that's quite a few years back. So around 2014, they were looking for a solution that would allow them to effectively leverage client and product profitability data. And they had that client and product profitability data that was in their financial data warehouse. So the data was there. The bank actually had already a solution to query the data. They were using Cognos Analytics. So the roadblock was not with the user interface. They were happy with Cognos Analytics. The roadblock wasn't with the data itself. It was actually a performance roadblock. The types of queries that analysts wanted to run were relatively slow. So what they had to do, they had to query a piece of it, of the data, then that might not have been what they were looking for, and they would drill back and drill down and drill back and drill down, and it just took too long. So it was too slow and too technical for what I like to call, let's say, business-centric query and analysis. So the bank decided to use Planning Analytics as an analytic data mart and leverage and use Cognos Analytics as the front end. And so in a way, the planning analytics became to that finance IT department what modern e-commerce portals are to consumers. You know, provided them with a guided, personalized, and say, instant gratification data shopping experience. And so thanks to planning analytics, the bank's analysts were now able to leverage Cognos analytics to query and analyze vast amount of profitability data and literally billions of records in seconds. And that provided, that was so successful because they were able to actually use a tool very effectively that the bank rapidly expanded the use of planning analytics. So it became their go-to place for finding answers for both broad and refined questions. And thanks to that initial project and what followed from it, the bank was able to climb the AI ladder and now conduct really way more extensive analysis. So if we look, for example, as events around the Greek financial crisis, events were unfolding, the bank needed quickly information on their exposure to Greek assets. And they used the planning analytics asset management cube, which contained every holding for every client across the world to answer the question in less than 10 minutes. That normally would have taken hours and hours and hours to do. So that such analysis, such insights then lead to further questions regarding their predictability. As in, you know, by analyzing client transaction data flows, for example, the firm was able to determine that their operational cash deposits of their clients were higher than thought. And they used predictive analytics, as in cognitive computing capabilities against this data, and they were able to prove out the operational nature of these deposits to regulatory bodies, hence freeing up millions of dollars in reserve holdings. And it goes on and on. So then the inclusion of risk data allowed the firm's analysts to perform risk-weighted product and client profitability analysis, as in which client may have been profitable, but really too risky, right? And in another example, there's the detailed analysis of expense data allowed the firm to save millions of dollars through optimization of vendor spend. And that was really literally as simple as having a data model that would allow analysts to ask questions quickly and get answers quickly.
So let's move on to the next, you know, term that I know that you've written about, the business analytics innovation loop. It sounds a little bit like getting into a virtuous cycle where incremental improvements to your business processes provide increasingly large amounts of ROI. Is that a fair description?
Yes, absolutely. Like if we look at that example from the bank before, the first planning analytics project was valuable, and the more they actually leverage the platform and the information architecture, the higher really the value and also the degree of innovation became that they got out of their total investment. So I'd say the business analytics innovation loop, it's a loose process that in the context of analytics software transformation really spurs in a innovation and improves competitiveness and by really actionably and continuously aligning vision, corporate vision, business strategy, processes, business processes, and initiatives. And this innovation loop aligns this around core business objectives. So, you know, if we look at innovative companies, how are those companies really different from the companies that want to be innovative? What do they do differently? It's really not the software that turned the innovative companies into innovators. It's really their outlook, their approach, and methodology. So those companies that continuously innovate, they inhibit a strong curiosity about change. They're driving a continuous assessment of gaps, inefficiencies, and limitations. And their focus is business process and analytic capabilities. And then they apply those assessments and desired states to define actionable and interlinked transformation strategies and roadmaps. And then they make sure that they're organized vertically and horizontally for execution, such that this strategy roadmap that they came up with can actually be executed upon. And last but not least, they continuously align those process data and infrastructure strategies and roadmaps. And that continuous realignment makes it a very dynamic process. And that's with that last realignment, that continuous realignment, that really ends up being like an innovation loop, because towards the end of a project, you learn something new that then will change yet another process improvement, possibly another way of looking at the data, which by itself will lead to other new innovation again and again and again and again. The most important part is start with process. It's culture and process. There are a lot of companies that start with just the software modernization, and that ends up often replicating what one had before with newer and better software. And that may sound good, newer and better software. It will look better. It will be probably a little bit faster, but it will not create the value that we're all hoping for. So if one thinks or hopes that software itself will bring about change, then that tends to be not be very helpful. Without process change, the new software will not do much better than the old. So process change is important, culture change, and as I had mentioned, actionable strategies. As in, if there is a mandate to improve FP&A, there needs to be an actionable strategy to go about doing that, and not hope that the introduction of the software itself will bring about, let's say, cultural change by itself.
That's valuable advice, Andreas. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, AG.
Well, that's it for today. Thank you for listening. We would love to hear from you. Do you have anything you would like to ask Qubit about analytics? You can tweet us at AskQubit or email us at info@qubit.com. That's info@QUEBIT.com. Until next time.